Welcome. This is the first of two rapid-fire introduction sessions to the latest happenings within EA organizations. This session will feature organizations working on cause prioritization, movement building, and existential risk. This is an Ignite speech format event, which means that every speaker will have only 5 minutes to make their point. They all get a deck of 20 slides, and each slide will advance automatically to the next slide after only 15 seconds. So this encourages people to get to the point fast. I'm going to be introducing each of the speakers. I'm Braden McLean, your MC for this event. To kick us off, Tim Tellen-Lawton is a graduate from Stanford University with a Bachelor of Science and a Master's of Science. He's working at GiveWell currently and took a swing at Earning to Give in 2011. He's been with GiveWell since January 2013. So please welcome Tim.
Thanks. All right. As you'll see, I've invested really heavily in the first slide. So my name's Tim. I've actually been, as you heard, working at GiveWell since 2013. And as many of you guys know, we do research on charities. And we actually end up recommending the ones in which we can be most confident are having a high impact per dollar. So the big question, of course, is how do you actually decide which organizations have the best impact per dollar? Well, there's four main criteria that we use. One is high-quality evidence of effectiveness, such as randomized controlled trials that can really isolate the positive impact that a given program is having. Two is actually being cost-effective, which we measure in terms of impact per dollar donated. The third main criteria that we actually look for is what we call room for more funding, which is the ability of an organization to take funding from more donations and create more good things. So it's more of a marginal approach rather than looking at the averages of the past. And the fourth main criteria that we use is transparency, because the vast majority of the information that we need to make these decisions isn't available online. So we have to go directly to the organizations and ask them to tell us the good, the bad, and the ugly about themselves in order to give us the confidence to recommend the best ones we can find. So using those criteria, we found four top charities that we currently recommend. One is the Against Malaria Foundation, which does bed net distribution in Africa to prevent malaria deaths. Two is GiveDirectly, which does $1,000 cash distributions to households in East Africa. You'll hear more about that later. Three and four are both deworming organizations, the Schistosomiasis Control Initiative, SCI, and the Deworm the World Initiative, which is part of Evidence Action. They give deworming pills to school-aged children to get them get rid of intestinal parasites. And there's evidence that this kind of work has huge long-term benefits, such as increased income down the line. So the big thing that we're focusing on right now is we're not satisfied with just having four top charities forever. We want to find more top charities that deserve this level of recommendation, and ideally even find organizations that have even higher cost effectiveness. So to that end, we've been talking to a lot more organizations, including another organization that does bed net distribution, more charities that do deworming, as well as some organizations that do other cost-effective programs like salt iodization, which has been shown to raise the IQs of children, and mass media in order to save childhood lives by improved health behaviors. So in addition to just talking to more charities that are out there, we're also working to cultivate the top charities of tomorrow. And there's a couple different things we're doing to make that happen. So one is helping replicate studies when there's a program that looks really promising but doesn't yet have the same high quality evidence that we would need to make a top charity recommendation or considered a priority program. The second thing that we're doing is actually doing scale-up of existing organizations that don't yet have the track record to demonstrate the same kind of experience that would make us comfortable making that top charity recommendation. And the third thing we're doing in order to cultivate top charities is actually looking to improve the monitoring and evaluation information, you know, the data straight from the ground that can give us a better insight into what's happening and how much impact different charities are having. So to that end, we're actually currently hiring an organization to work with SCI, which is already a top charity, but we both want to understand them better. And also, if that works well, we could hopefully use the same model to understand other charities that otherwise wouldn't be able to receive a top charity recommendation at all. So those are the big things we're doing to increase the number of top charities on our list. To make all that happen, we need more research capacity, and so we've been hiring, training, and managing new staff, increasing our own management capacity. So when I joined in 2013, there was actually 5 full-time staff when we moved from New York to San Francisco. Now we're over mid-20s, and by the end of the year, we're going to be passing 30 staff, which is a lot and hard to imagine even for me. But it's actually a really exciting time to grow as well. In fact, I want to have anyone that works full-time at GiveWell or is interning there this summer to raise your hands so that people can come talk to you afterwards if you guys have more questions and are curious to learn more about GiveWell. So thanks so much. I'm really excited to be here and to learn more from everyone else at this conference. Thanks.
Good timing. One order of business, just I'm looking for a couple more speakers who are yet to show themselves. Is Charlie Bressler in the house? Come up to the front, that would be fantastic, please. Also, if Howie Lempel is around, maybe. Thank you. And Anthony Aguirre? Fantastic, thank you. So our second speaker today is Michael Fay, who's the co-founder and executive director of GiveDirectly. GiveDirectly is a top GiveWell recommended charity. Michael's work in international development has been published in the American Economic Review, booking papers on economic activity, and he has a PhD in business economics from Harvard. Please welcome Michael.
As the clock started. All right, welcome to the first ever GiveDirectly Ignite talk. I think I have 5 minutes to go through the history of how we founded it, the future, and everything in between. So if you like this one, there'll be a longer one tomorrow, so please do come to that. So we started with this classic problem, donor recipient, how do I do the most good for the recipient? When we looked at the sector back in the mid-2000s, it looked reasonably complicated. There were multiple layers of intermediates. It was hard to figure out where the money was going. And it was really a sector that was designed to allocate capital on behalf of the poor. We made decisions for the poor. Two things changed in the mid-2000s. The first was that mobile banking really started to explode. And this isn't just mobile phones, but it's the fact that we can now reach hundreds of millions of people through final mile payment solutions. The second thing that happened was the introduction of experimental evidence to development. And what we found was lots of things that we thought worked didn't, and lots of things that we never would have thought worked, like cash transfers, did. So what did we do? We looked back at this old model and said, do we need these layers of intermediates? Do we need all this cost? Or could we actually do something that's much simpler? And in some sense, it was obvious when you think ubiquitous payments, evidence. So we did this, which is we connected the donor to the recipient directly. And there are a couple of things that we liked about this, and I think a lot of the things that we liked are similar to the EA values. One was that it had an evidence base. Two, it was a very efficient way of helping the poor, and the direct channel actually let us be transparent. So what are we doing? I think we're not just doing the operations and the execution of cash. We want to think much bigger. How can we have policy impact? And we'll come back to the policy impact. Before we do, I just want to give a very quick update on kind of how GiveDirectly's operations have changed. The operations are really core to what we do, and there are 4 basic stages: targeting, auditing, transferring, and monitoring, which are almost ubiquitous in all cash programming. So the first step was targeting. I think we always used housing material, or we initially used housing material, to identify poor from others. We've started experimenting a bit with this, things like community-based targeting, using our staff to subjectively ask how poor folks are, and we'll come to that. 2 is auditing. I think auditing is key. How do you know the right people are getting transfers? So we've just implemented a new technology platform, which will actually let us digitally audit every decision that gets made in the cash program. Three was payments. We started in the easiest place possible, Kenya, with M-Pesa. We've since moved not just to mobile money, but the classic bank branches, debit cards, and so forth. The last is monitoring. I think we've always thought it was really important to have a vertically integrated operation. And I think we've continued to see how we can actually integrate our evaluation with things like staff compensation and incentives more broadly for the org. So what did we find? We found surprises. This is my favorite surprise. Lots of people built metal roofs. Metal roofs are probably the worst thing to fundraise for. They're not that interesting, but they turn out to actually be pretty impactful for the poor. Beyond the metal roofs, we did an RCT with IPA, and I won't go through all of the specific effects that we saw, but it was a pretty dramatic impact on things like income, assets, malnutrition, and stress levels and overall happiness. We think the impact can go beyond these direct impacts, though, and I think we're trying to set new standards for transparency as well. This is a kind of hopefully up-to-date picture of our website, where you see in the top left the dashboard that we use to manage the organization. That information is real time. What are we doing next? So we don't want to just share data. We want to share every recipient's story. We're launching a mobile app, hopefully later this year, that will actually let you see each of these stories. And we're not going to filter them. We're not going to edit them. It'll be an unedited kind of view of what recipients' lives are really like. Now the bad part. We are small. We are tiny. And when you look at this graph, GiveWell's top charity room for funding is less than a tenth of a percent of development assistance. We need to start thinking about how we're going to impact the broader sector. And the reason for that is, while we debate highly effective interventions here, that 99.9% is highly ineffective for the most case. And Haiti's the most recent example, which received a lot of press. So how do we do that? And I think the Give Directly and the cash transfer narrative has changed in the last few years. A few years ago, we were an experiment. That experiment is over in many ways. And now people are starting to ask questions, whether it's DFID and other organizations, The Economist, Foreign Affairs, what's the implication for the sector if cash transfers really are this impactful? So how do we move from experiment to sectoral change? And when you ask the question of, well, what does sectoral change actually look like, I think the best way to answer that is by analogy, which is the index fund, which is not only grown to, I think, 25% of overall assets managed, but has a dramatic impact on the way we actually think about other kind of active managers, in the sense that it set a benchmark. It set the new standard that active managers now need to beat. So if you want to hear more tomorrow, and thanks a lot.
Thank you. Charlie Bressler is the executive director of The Life You Can Save. Prior to his role at The Life You Can Save, Charlie was the president of The Men's Warehouse, a public retail apparel company. Charlie received his MAT in history and teaching from Harvard University and his PhD in social and clinical psychology from Clark University. Please welcome Charlie.
This is, or can I move it right on here? This advances it? Okay, this is great. Okay. Well, it's really a privilege to be here. I feel like I'm here among so many young people. There's an advantage to being old, but there's a lot of disadvantages, one of which is speed. So here I have to give an Ignite talk, not to mention the fact that I was a distance runner and not a sprinter, but I will do my best. It's also a real privilege, I have to say, to go after GiveWell and Give Directly, two organizations that are very important to The Life You Can Save. And we're actually, I guess the simplest thing I could say is we're trying to publicize the great work that they're doing, and that's really a critical part of our mission. So it's really nice to be here after them. Just to review, in 2009, Peter Singer published the book, The Life You Can Save, and provide an ethical and practical basis for fighting extreme poverty. And many of you know the Girl in the Pond video. And he launched a website with a woman from Poland named Agata. And it received a lot of pledges initially, and they received a steady state between 2009 and 2013 of about 5,000 visitors to the website a month. In early 2013, the organization received an injection of cash, and we were able to hire a small staff, and I became the new volunteer executive director, a position I still hold. But at this point, I wanted to say that I have three teammates here. Laura Gamzee, who's got a camera somewhere, so you'll know what she does for us, lots of things like that. John Behar, who's the chief operating officer and director of philanthropy education, and you'll hear about Giving Games later. John, are you here? He's heard me talk, so he's already bored. And Claire Knowlton, who's our board chair, who's right there. So I will look forward to talking to you all and answering questions and learning from you after this. And I realize there's no time. So our goals are really simple. Our goals are quite simple, but they're also very difficult to execute, as everyone in the room knows. We want to move incremental money, an interesting concept, which I'm sure we'll talk about throughout the weekend, to 16 currently recommended charities, 8 of whom come from GiveWell and 8 come from elsewhere, which I won't get into right now. We want to engage in philanthropy education, which will assist over time many other organizations, many of which represented here, in changing the culture of philanthropy, and John's Giving Games are a centerpiece of that. And then we set a goal when I originally talked to Peter about putting the money into the organization. With my wife, we had a heartfelt conversation about the hope that we would move a multiple of what we spend, and we believe we're on track to do that, but I'm sure we can have some very spirited debates about what constitutes incrementality. So in terms of our progress, we estimated that in 2014, we moved a modest $750,000, which was 3x of our expenses. We didn't impute any dollars for our pledges, and we didn't impute any dollars for future giving to Giving Games, but clearly we also took credit for money that may have come through Peter and others that maybe we would have gotten in the movement anyway. So there's lots of debates about that. Our Giving Games program is doubling annually. So how do we do it? We make effective giving easier, and we hope to make it easier and easier over time. We have an impact calculator that Laura helped create, which we think is a tool that is, of course, open source and can be used by others. We use some psychological strategies that we think will make it easier. We're differentiated from giving what we can in that we focus primarily on personal best as opposed to the initial pledge. We're trying to build relationships with high net worth individuals, corporations, and media. So those are some of the strategies. Opportunities you can see. We think Giving Games is a potential home run opportunity, as are some of our relationships we're evolving with high net worth individuals, and the opportunity to make our website stronger as a base. But our website will just be a base. And challenges, as I'm sure people in the room know, fundraising for meta charities is complicated. Explaining them to the public are difficult, and a small but growing staff, where we have to grow prudently to make sure that we are hitting our goal that we've established with Peter of trying to move incremental money that is a multiple of what we spend, and we're supplemented with some key volunteers, and we've missed on projects that we can't take on yet, but we hope to take on as we gain more funding. Thank you very much, and thank you for allowing me to be here.
Thanks, Charlie. Next up, Nate Suarez. Nate is the executive director at Miri. Previously, he was a software engineer at Google, who joined the research team at Miri in 2014, quickly earning a very strong reputation. He's currently the author of Miri's Technical Agenda. Thank you, Nate.
Yeah, hello. I'm the executive director of the Machine Intelligence Research Institute. What's been going on in the field around us? Thanks. Who we are, what's been going on in the field around us, what we've been up to, and where we're going. So who we are, our mission is to ensure that the creation of smarter than human machine intelligence has a beneficial impact. How did this work? There we go. Science and technology are responsible for incredible changes in human and animal welfare, both for the better and for the worse. Science and technology are products of intelligence. If we can automate scientific and technological improvement, then human progress could be sped up quite quickly or cut short prematurely, depending on how we use the technology. The stakes here are as high as stakes can go, And we do technical research to make sure that by the time humans figure out how to create smarter than human machines, they also know how to build beneficial machines. We've been around for a number of years. We started out doing a lot of movement building. A couple of years ago, we pivoted to technical research, which I'll tell you about in a minute. But first, let me tell you about what's been going on in the field around us. About 12 months ago, Nick Bostrom of the Future of Humanity Institute published the book Superintelligence: Paths, Dangers, Strategies, which sparked a lot of conversation about the long-term impacts of artificial intelligence research. This culminated in a conference by the Future of Life Institute in Puerto Rico. This picture was taken there. It brought together top industry leaders, academics, and representatives from the existential risk reduction community. There was a quick consensus that there are many challenges ahead. We put out an open letter, which called for more research to keep AI beneficial. This was paired with a priorities document, which cites our work extensively, and a $10 million donation from Elon Musk. This and other things, including Nick Bostrom's book, led to lots of public attention from public figures, including Stephen Hawking and Bill Gates. And it has been quite a pleasure over the last year to watch these conversations take an international stage after incubating for so long. Now let me talk about what we've been doing. Over the last year, we have flown around the world to conferences, run a series of workshops, run a summer fellows program, published 6 peer-reviewed papers in various conferences or books, put up 10 other technical reports online, and put up dozens of preliminary results on a research forum that we host for both our researchers and interested collaborators. We did all this on a team of 3. So imagine what more we could do with a team of 6 or 8 or more. We've been imagining this, and so we've hired a couple more people. And in fact, these slides are currently out of date, because as of this morning, we have an IMO perfect scoring ex-Googler who has decided to come onto the team. So we're growing, and we're going to grow faster. And the reason we want to grow faster is there's a lot more to do. So AI alignment research is only just beginning. Right now, there are billions of dollars and thousands of person years pouring into increasing AI capabilities, and to my knowledge, fewer than 10 people working full-time on AI alignment. So we've been thinking for a long time about what can be done in this space and what sort of technical research can be done in this space. This is sort of one of our bigger assets. We've been thinking about this for a while, and now that more and more people are getting interested, we think it's time to grow and move quickly. This is why we're currently running a fundraiser. It's somewhat aggressive. We have some ambitious targets. We hit our first one 2 days ago. And as part of the fundraiser, I've been writing quite a bit about what our plans are, what we've been up to, and where we're going. If you want to learn more, you can go to intelligence.org/info. So that's what's going on, where we are, where we're going. As a recap, if we can automate scientific and technological advancement, we have the opportunity to raise standard of living everywhere, if we know how to use the tools wisely. We're working to ensure that we can use the tools wisely. It's been an astonishing year. The technical research is well underway, and there's lots of room to grow. Thanks.
Thanks, Nate. Next up is Seb Fakwa. Seb is the Executive Director of the Center for Effective Altruism. Seb leads CEA's policy work with the Global Priorities Project. In fact, Seb is giving back-to-back presentations, first on the CEA and then on the Global Priorities Project. He's got a background in consulting at McKinsey and has been heavily involved in effective altruism ever since founding 80,000 Hours, co-founding.
Thank you very much. Hi, I'm Sebastian. Like he said, I'm going to be giving 2 talks with 2 different hats. So I'll stand over here for one, and then I'll move over when it's clear that I'm representing a different person. So I'm here with the Center for Effective Altruism, and what we do is we foster projects that use evidence and use analysis to help others as much as possible. So one thing that differentiates us from a lot of other effective altruist organizations is that we don't just pick one horse. We like to support a range of different projects. In fact, originally, CEA grew out of two projects that seem on the face of it to be very different. One was Giving What We Can, which is sort of a donor community, an organization with roots in global poverty and global public health. And the other, 80,000 Hours, which is a career advice organization. Superficially, they didn't seem to have that much in common, but we realized as a community, as these things were developing side by side in Oxford, that there was a powerful idea that underlay both of these. And we searched around for a name for that, and Effective Altruism was the best name we ended up coming up with. And so we decided to create a center for Effective Altruism. Now, we've been growing incredibly quickly over the last few years. You can see our graph there of the spending over time. We're roughly doubling every year, and at the moment we have about 20 full-time staff working on projects of CEA. But I hope that everybody here is roughly on the same page, that we don't actually care about the growth in our inputs. What we care about is the growth in our impact. And I'm pleased to say that that seems to be growing at an even faster rate. So we seem to be getting more efficient at turning our inputs into impact over time. One thing we've noticed is that at 80,000 hours, for example, we seem to be roughly twice as efficient at turning resources into significant plan changes as we were before. And we expect that's going to keep growing as we get better at supporting the different projects, passing people between different campaigns that we're running, and better using our existing resources. So you can see up there a bunch of the exciting impact results that we're getting. A lot of the projects, when they pick their metric that they want to improve over the next year, they're getting something like 10 times improvement over that metric over the course of the year. And for the really key metrics that we think are most important, we're all growing them very significantly, moving much more money than we would have even imagined possible through Giving What We Can, say, just a couple years ago. Now, I touched earlier on the fact that we've got a lot of different projects at the Center for Effective Altruism. And there's a very important reason for that, which is something that came up in the keynote earlier today, which is this idea of cause neutrality, the idea that we don't necessarily know what the best project to work on is, partly for, you know, because we don't know the answers to all the empirical questions, and partly because there are important philosophical questions that still need to be solved too. So we don't want to back just one horse. We also believe that different people who believe different things are the most important causes can work together effectively and support each other, and that we make a lot more progress as an effective altruist community if we work alongside people who are working at slightly different aims, but who share with us this idea that we're trying to make the biggest positive impact for the world that we can. And that, I think, is one of the most important things that CEA stands for. We've got a range of projects. We've got Giving What We Can, which works on global poverty and global public health mostly, and builds a community of donors who pledge to give at least a tenth of their income. They'll have a talk like this tomorrow, which I recommend you guys should go to. 80,000 Hours is a career advice organization. They've been doing some stellar stuff trying to give people who want to make a difference with their careers the tips they need to do that as effectively as possible. We have my own project, the Global Priorities Project, which I'll talk about in a sec when I move over to that side of the stage, so I won't say much about that now. And then we have a range of other things which are really exciting, which don't necessarily all have their own project name. For example, we're organizing this conference, which I hope everybody agrees is a fantastic thing for us to be doing, and I'm glad you're all here. And I'm glad that so far it seems to be going really well. We'll see how that goes. We also have Effective Altruism Ventures, which I'm also extremely excited about as a project. This is one of our newest projects. This is connecting donors to entrepreneurs in the EA community to get exciting projects that might not otherwise be happening to flourish and to get off the ground. We've started making our first grants to EA Policy, which is an organization setting up in Washington to get involved in the open comment period for various political decisions. We think that's a really promising move. And if any of you guys are entrepreneurs who want funding, you should come talk to EA Ventures and we can try to set you up. I'll now move over to the other side of the stage where I talk about the Global Priorities Project. And before I do that, I also want to mention one thing, which is true for GPP, is also true for CEA. We're growing really fast, and one of the things that means is we need more people. We need people doing a lot of things, whether that's fundraising, program management, research. if you're in this room and are looking for a job in that kind of space, you should come talk to me afterwards, because I'd love to talk to you, or if you know people who are. The Global Priorities Project focuses on two quite separate things, which we think work together really well. One of them is this idea of prioritization, working out what the most important causes are to work on, working out how to pick those causes, how to weigh things over time, doing the analysis we need for that sort of thing. And the audience there is mostly the people in this room, the people in CEA, effective altruists, who are trying to make these sorts of decisions. But when we apply that kind of model to the level of governments, for example, and assume that governments are trying to do as much as they can with their resources, we get into the world of policy, which is something where we've also been making a lot of progress. Our prioritization work is evident around this building, and you guys should take every opportunity you have to engage with it, because I think some of it's really exciting. We've been looking into movement building, which is one of the things that we're all here to do today, trying to work out when you're building a movement, should you be focusing on the eventual size that your movement might be able to achieve? Should you be trying to maximize the local growth rate of your movement? Is it important to do direct work, and how do you balance off doing direct work with movement building? That's one of the things we've been looking at. One of the things that I think is most promising, and we might expand substantially, is our work on cause selection, because this is a problem that every single person in this room is facing today. The question is, which cause should I devote my attention to? Should we as a community devote our attention to? And why do we make the decisions that we make there? So what we've been doing is mapping out all of the reasons that people have, all of the empirical questions, all of the philosophical questions that lead people to support one cause rather than another. This has two benefits. One, it helps us understand where we're all coming from and have a clearer conversation. But two, and I think this is even more important, it helps us target our research at the crucial considerations that make it easy for us in the future to change our mind about which causes are best. So some of these are really obvious empirical questions of the sort that the people at GiveDirectly are looking at. How much bang for my buck can I get by using this type of poverty intervention relative to some other poverty intervention? That's one level. But then there are other levels. For example, to what extent we should believe that we can impact and affect the far future. If we think that we're really bad at projecting that stuff, then we should avoid interventions that focus on the far future. But if we think we can do it well, then we should do more of that. And that's an empirical question that we need to analyze, and that doing this sort of research reveals as a key point. And then we take some of that stuff and we move it into policy. And this, for me, is a major growth area for effective altruism. And I say that because policymakers are very influential. Developed world governments control about 30% of GDP across the OECD, which makes it a huge place for us to potentially have a large impact by changing people's minds. And I also say it because in our experience so far, policymakers have been surprisingly receptive to the EA mindset and to the tools that we value highly. And I say that in particular because I don't think that effective altruism has an answer on a lot of political questions. In fact, we've been deliberately avoiding trying to get involved in standard political debates because we think they're not neglected. We don't think there's that much room to move the needle. But what can be really effective is applying the tools that we all buy into, evidence-based, using expected value calculations where you can, being clever about how you weigh up the future, how you weigh up a risk, trying to be even-handed and trying as much as we can to be unbiased in how we want to spread resources across society. All of these are things that resonate really strongly with some policymakers, and we've been having a lot of very positive conversations and making a lot of progress. We've been looking at evidence-based government decision-making, which resonates, like I say, really strongly with a lot of decision-makers, trying to do things like training MPs in how to use evidence, talking to people about how the civil servants, about how they should weigh up risk when they're doing their projects. This is all very exciting for me. We're looking at technological risk, which is something that a bunch of our, you know, the other speakers here today are looking at. We've been working very closely with the Future of Humanity Institute in some of our projects. Most recently, we are supporting the Finnish government in working out a good strategy for dealing with existential risk and international coordination. Like I say, I would love to talk to anybody here who's interested in hearing more, working with us, donating to us. Come grab me after the talk. I'll be there.
Thank you, Sebastian. Our next talker is Anthony Aguirre, a professor at UC Santa Cruz, a founder alongside Max Tegmark of the Foundational Questions Institute. Anthony worked on a wide variety of topics in theoretical cosmology, ranging from intergalactic galaxy formation to gravity physics to the large-scale structure of inflationary universe and the arrow of time. Thank you, Anthony.
Thanks. So, I'll be giving a status report on the Future of Life Institute. It was founded about a year ago, and it's been an exciting year, and I want to keep you up to date on what we've been up to and why. So FLI was formed because we think that humanity really is at a crossroads where we could go on for thousands or millions of years in exponentially expanding happiness throughout the universe or not. So a lot of terrible things could happen to the world. Fortunately, many of them are in the far future, the ones that we can't do anything about, and the ones that are in the near future we can do something about, largely because we might cause them. But we can do something about them, and so FLI was formed to try to figure out what we can do and try to actually do it. It was created by these five people, two of which are here, so you can look for us, Vika and I. And we attracted an amazing advisory board by promising them that they wouldn't have to actually do anything. We didn't totally keep that promise. We didn't promise that to the volunteers. But nonetheless, they showed up, and FLI is an almost entirely a volunteer-run organization. It's been really heartening to see how much work they put in. FLI was launched in spring 2014 with an event at MIT talking about AI, nanotechnology, biotechnology, autonomous weapons, all kinds of future technologies. We quickly focused in on artificial intelligence. Why? Because after a long period of kind of disappointment, AI has suddenly started to become competent. Watson winning Jeopardy, self-driving cars, killing CAPTCHA that was built to defeat AI. But really competent agents tend to achieve their goals. And so as AI gets more general and more powerful, we really have to make sure that those goals and how they are achieved are consonant with what we as humans really want. If you think about having your own genie, you start to get more and more worried as you think about it. So this led to a conference in Puerto Rico, held largely because Boston looked like this. And the goals, this conference had a few key goals. One of them was to just get these sorts of people together from the philanthropic, the nonprofit, the industry, the academic research communities together in a room talking with each other. And that happened. We were surprised at how happily and productively they talked together. Another was to build some sort of consensus on some technical issues of what should we actually do as research in keeping artificial intelligence, as we've termed it, beneficial and robust. And this led to this sort of meaty 15-page document that Nate discussed earlier. It also led to an open letter kind of declaring that this is something we want to do. We want to keep AI doing what we want it to do. This is sort of self-evident, but most research, essentially all, had gone into making AI more capable, not making it necessarily do what we want. We were also fortunate that we were able to get funding to put this research into motion from Elon Musk and joined by the Open Philanthropy Project. That research made kind of a splash. Not the most helpful necessarily one. It seems to put AI researchers on edge when they're constantly compared to the Terminator. But in fact, the research grants that were funded through a sort of careful peer review process, we had 300 initial proposals. We ended up funding 37 of them with committed $7.2 million provided by those donors, are really interesting technical problems that the AI research community, I think, has really gotten behind. What we're doing right now, the topic of the day, is another open letter trying to call for a ban on offensive autonomous weapons. This has proved very popular with AI researchers who don't want to really be responsible for a new arms race in the next stage of warfare. We're doing outreach to both AI researchers and to journalists to try to reduce the Terminator usage and get more subtlety and understanding of what the real problems with super intelligent or just very competent AI is. We're now looking for what we're going to do in the future. Of course, continue to work on AI research and safety, thinking about biotechnology and attendant risks and various other possible risks. Our capabilities, I would say, in stock photo form are some funding, volunteers, organization, and a network of interesting researchers that we can connect with. Our capabilities do not include real physical offices or research staff or administrative support. This makes us be extra altruistic because we're happy to help things happen other places and just donate the credit. And it also means that if you want to come visit us, you just have to visit me or Vika or any of the other ones of us. And so we'll look forward to seeing you at the meeting.
Closing out our Ignite series of talks, we have Neil Bauman, the Director of Operations at the Future of Humanity Institute. Neil is the co-founder of the Center for Effective Altruism and has also co-founded the Global Priorities Project, a climate policy think tank, and was also part of the 80,000 Hours founding team. Neil has a PhD in physics from Oxford. Please welcome Neil.
Hi. I crammed quite a lot into this talk, so I'm going to speak a bit faster than the other speakers, but let me know if I should slow down. So what is the Future of Humanity Institute? We are a multidisciplinary research team working on questions relating to how to improve the long-run future of humanity. What sorts of questions are they? We try and work on questions that are both important but also neglected. So we sit at that intersection right there. How neglected do I mean? Well, for example, these are the number of papers published on dung beetles, the number of... This should go a little bit faster. Can I grab the clicker? Yeah, and the number of papers on snowboarding and zinc oxalate. And then you'll be interested to know these are the number of papers ever written on human extinction. So it's a little bit neglected compared to some of these other topics, and we want to increase that over time. So this is the sort of question that we work on. We work on sort of systematizing this, designing heuristics around this, defining what we mean by human extinction in terms like existential risk. An existential risk is anything that could permanently curtail humanity's long-run future. So this could be something like human extinction, but also a locked-in global totalitarian state, which prevents humanity from having as positive a long-run future as it might otherwise have. So these are some of the sorts of questions we think about. Also, artificial intelligence and how to ensure that superhuman intelligences can maintain... ensure that we're able to maintain robust human control over smarter than human level artificial intelligence. So Nick Bostrom, who was the founder of the Future of Humanity Institute, wrote a book last year, which has been mentioned so far, Superintelligence. It was a New York Times bestseller, was endorsed by Bill Gates, and as has been mentioned, this helped spark off a global discussion alongside groups like the Future of Life Institute and MIRI. And so this is Nick Bostrom. He co-founded the Future of Humanity Institute about a decade ago. And since then, it's been growing considerably. We have a number of researchers here at the conference. So everyone up on this slide is part of our multidisciplinary research team or management teams. And you can find all of these people here, and you can talk to them throughout the conference. Here's some of the other people who are here who are at FHI. Toby Ord, the founder of Giving What We Can, Hilary Greaves, who runs our population ethics program, and Eric Drexler, the father of modern nanotechnology. So all of these folks are some of the people who hang out at FHI and help us do our research. So we are located within Oxford University, and we share offices and host the Center for Effective Altruism. The Global Priorities Project, which I co-founded last year, is a joint collaboration between the two of us. They have a whole bunch of other programs, including Effective Altruism Global, where you are now. And we have a bunch of research streams that we work on as well, like AI safety, macro strategy, population ethics, and systemic risk. We're trying to scale down the latter two to focus on the former two, which I'll talk about in a moment. So AI safety, we've already discussed this a little bit. We have a number of researchers working on these sorts of questions about how do you ensure robust control of a system once it delivers certain levels of intelligence capabilities. These are two good places to go if you want to learn more about this, both written by FHRI researchers, but the one on the right published by Miri. And our other major research area is macro strategy. This is designing heuristics to help make the long-run future go better. So one example of this is differential technological development. This is the idea that you want to get some technologies faster than others if you want to improve your chances of doing well. So for example, we'd want a universal flu vaccine before gain-of-function research. So the Global Priorities Project, Seb has already spoken about this. But one thing I did want to highlight is in the past year, this slide hasn't shown up, but we wrote a report which looks very beautiful and would be there. This was circulated at the highest levels of UK government. It was on unprecedented technological risk. And it was read by a number of other governments around the world, the German government, the Finnish government, and then was adopted into a chapter of the UK government chief scientist annual report. So this is an example of FHI, CEA collaborating on what I thought was a very exciting project. So some recent updates from us. We've had some major funding success. We've got lots of money in the past few months from all of these folks. And as a result, we're now heavily talent constrained. So we are currently hiring, and we're looking to hire a lot of different people. For example, one area is emerging technological governance. We're looking for people with expertise in policy, but also preferably some experience in emerging tech governance. If you know anyone who might fit this bill and is interested in coming to Oxford to work with us, I'd love to speak with you. So please do grab me afterwards. These are examples of all the organizations that we have been advising in recent years on some of these sorts of issues. So there'll be a lot of work for them to do. We are also looking for people to help us build our macro strategy program. We are looking for historians of science and tech, futurologists, tech entrepreneurs with big visions about how technology is going to evolve over the coming years, and economists, but generally people who can help us design heuristics to make the long-run future go better. Finally, we're looking for machine learning specialists, people with expertise in deep learning, Q-learning, reinforcement learning, but who also have a deep interest in AI safety. So if you know folks like that who might be interested in working with our team, please do let me know. So that's it from me. Thanks a lot.